Plant on the Line, this is thecommentary.ca. Jeff Warren is a former producer at CBC Radio's The Current. His two-hour-long Ideas documentary on the science of sleep became the basis for his new book, The Head Trip, Adventures on the Wheel of Consciousness. The book, published by Random House and retailing for $34.95, looks at the 12 distinct natural states of consciousness we experience in a 24-hour day. We are apparently not merely awake or asleep or dreaming. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Jeff Warren. Good morning, Mr. Warren.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Now, there are, as you read in the book, 12 states of consciousness that we're in. We can get to all 12 of these states without drugs?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I should just say, it's not the 12, it's just 12. There are, you know, hundreds of different states of consciousness you could probably profile. I was trying to figure out what the most elemental are, and those are the 12 that I talk about, but that's my taxonomy, as it were. Someone else might come up with different sets. They're just the ones that I see as being the most elemental.
Before we get into some of these states, is this the first book of its kind?
Well, it kind of is, in a way. You know, since consciousness has gotten back in the sort of research limelight, and that's kind of happened in the past 20 years. There's been books on neurological theories about what might be happening in the brain. There's always been plenty of philosophy books about consciousness. This is the first book written really from the point of view of the subject, like what it is like to be, what it feels like to be aware at different times of day and night and in dreaming. So in that sense, it's the first really of its kind that's tried to describe really the consciousness from the inside and how it changes, and it looks at both all the things that are happening at night and in dreams, but also in the day, kind of as this holistic whole. This is the first one.
How has the scientific community reacted to the book?
Well, we'll find out. All of the chapters that I wrote, I've had a scientist read them in their field, and the reaction has been very positive. They give me tips on where I could fix my neurobiology, because I'm not a neurobiologist by any means. But so far it's been pretty good. But I have to say, I am a little apprehensive. I think the book itself is not at all a typical science book. It's a very, it's really kind of weird and creative, and it's as much about the sort of the journey that I go through, and I consider it as much a creative work as I do a kind of more scientific and journalistic one. And I think that for some scientists who are into that, they're going to really like it. I think others, there may be some, kind of the more hardcore plumber neurology types, who will not get what I'm trying to do and be more critical. But we'll find out.
It's a very funny book, and it's highly readable, I must say. And we get a lot of your personality in it, which is very entertaining at times. But we won't get into all 12 states, because it's impossible to do that. I mean, people ought to buy the book, I think, because it's not only informative but entertaining a read. I just want to go into a couple of things that relate to me personally, I guess. This has happened to me. I'll be lying in bed, about to go to bed, like wanting to go to sleep, essentially, and my arm will jerk very quickly, or my leg will, and I'm wide awake. What is that that's happening?
Yeah, that's called, those are called myoclonic jerks, which, as an aside, I think would be a fantastic name for a punk band, the myoclonic jerks. And it's basically a release of muscle tension. It's partly what's going on. You also have these little, as you're falling asleep, there's a kind of changing of the neurochemical guard in your brain, and your brainstem starts firing in all these little electrical kind of pulses that come up. And I think that those probably play a role in, making you twitch like that. One of the interesting things about that is that, we all experience that as these little dream narratives that you're, falling downstairs or you're slipping on the ice. And we imagine that that's why we're jerking, is because of that's part of the story. But in fact, the jerk itself is probably incoming a little earlier than that. There's probably a kind of trigger that would cause the jerk that's coming along, and then your brain just improvises with this little mini dream scenario on the fly. So in fact, it's not the dream of falling that makes you twitch. It's the twitch that makes the dream of falling.
And that sort of narrative, or that sort of, for lack of a better word, that movie that goes on in your head, before that. Is that, I mean, is that chemical? Is that something that, because of something you're afraid of, or?
No, I mean, I think it's like that those myoclonic jerks are kind of natural. They're sort of part of the automatic hardware that happen, and then the mind just improvises over top of that physiology. But, you know, you bring up an important question in the sense that there's this constant thing I'm exploring in the book between levels of things that are going on in the mind versus levels of things that are going on in the brain, and it's not, sometimes there is a clear cause and effect, other times not at all. Other times, things going on in the mind, as it were, are affecting things in the brain. Now, I know that's being very dualist. Of course, they're part of a single system, but it's you learn all kinds of crazy things when you really start to get into how the mind-brain works, and it's not always clear what the relationship is.
And I guess the troubling thing about that is the effect is that it's negative in terms that you're awake. You can't go back to sleep, it seems.
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, in the sense that the jerk can kind of suddenly wake you up and prevent you from falling asleep.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It may be that it's not one of those, it may not be an adaptive thing. They just may be some byproduct of something else happening that you get those little jerks. Most people don't have it so badly that they're not able to ultimately fall asleep. It's just a kind of little, you can think of it as a little bit of a little byproduct activity of falling asleep that probably wasn't intended.
And when we're asleep, are we still conscious?
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the main points I make in the book, is that consciousness doesn't just turn off when the lights go and we fall asleep. In fact, it just sort of changes shape. It's like all of a sudden we go from being immersed in a model of the world built from sensory input, walking around using the sights and sounds and smells, to suddenly immersing ourselves in a model of the world built from memory and experience, and that's dreaming. Now, there are times in the night, for example, in the first half of the night, we go through something called slow wave sleep, which is deep, thought to be sort of dreamless sleep. And then if when you wake people up from slow wave sleep, there's very little going on. There is often some mentation. It's not that, they used to think that it was just a completely empty space, but actually a lot of people are having dreams in that time, or they're having just sort of low-level thought, like they're wondering about their laundry or about, you know, their taxes. I mean, it tends to be kind of very prosaic concerns, kind of like a really banal kind of daydreaming. But no, the key thing is that, I mean, consciousness itself, in the sense that some kind of awareness going on in your head, is pretty much 24 hours. And that's a very radical thing to say, and almost nobody would say that, but that's what I found from investigating these states. So
how do we know then, when we're asleep, what we're thinking about?
How do we know what we're thinking about when we're asleep? Well,
because very often you'll wake up and you'll sort of, just as you're waking up, you'll think, I've had a sort of vivid, exciting dream. So you're running down someplace or you're being chased by something. But you can't remember the details of it right when you get up.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, that's the whole point, I think. The reason why so many people think that we're not conscious at night is, and the reason is, our short-term memory is more or less disengaged at nighttime, both in REM sleep and in slow-wave sleep. So it's not that we're not having experiences, it's that we don't remember them. When we're in a dream, it's incredibly real, and we're responding to situations. Only afterwards, we wake up, you know, we forget it. And you can see why that would be the case if we remembered our dreams. Let's give you an example, like a cat, or say you're a mouse, and you have a dream that the cat next door dies. You wake up from your dream, and you think, oh, wow, the cat next door died. And then you go next door, and the cat's still there, and you get eaten, and it's not adaptive, you know. So there's a good reason why we don't remember our dreams. But fortunately, since we're human beings, and we have culture, and we have language, we have found ways to remember our dreams. And you can actually kind of trump the physical processes that are happening by learning to improve your dream recall. And you do that just by, when you wake up in the morning, you try to write down everything you remember, and every day you keep doing that, and eventually you'll find you get better and better at able to remember what happened.
Do we know what our dreams mean? Are they what we want, or are they what we fear?
I think what we fear, that's a very smart thing. I think that's very wise. I think that they often are those things. Your dreams, there's no question they reflect your preoccupations, your flashpoints, emotional things in your lives, like the things that you're doing. And I have a whole theory that I put forward. It's not mine. It's this guy, Stephen LaBerge, who's a very smart psychologist. And he talks about dreams as being these kind of unfolding of these, what he calls, schemas. And in a sense, find yourself in a dream on a dark, shadowy street, you might look around and think, oh God, this is the kind of street where muggers hang out. And then suddenly a mugger appears. And you think, oh God, I bet that mugger's going to chase me. And suddenly the mugger starts to chase you. And you think, oh no, I bet he's going to catch me. And suddenly he does catch you. I mean, there's this quality in which your dreams are self-fulfilling in that way. So they're really revealing about your own opinions and assumptions about the world, among other things.
And do we dream every night?
Absolutely, we dream every night.
Why is it sometimes we think we don't?
Oh, just because we can't remember them. And I think if you have a short night's sleep, you spend more of that time in slow-wave sleep, and there tends to be much less vivid dreams. The most vivid dreams we have happen kind of later on in the night. So I think that that kind of probably plays into it as well. But it's just amazing how... I mean, the other thing is about some people really remember their dreams well, others don't. You know, it doesn't mean they're not dreaming, it just means that they have a recall issue.
I'm just thinking about people with mental issues, or mental health issues, I should say, or people who are drug users or intoxicated, where dreaming and that sort of thing can be affected by medication, perhaps, or lifestyle choices, or by illness. Do you look at that in your book in any way?
I don't. Oh, it's a fascinating topic, though, and you're absolutely right that there is different drugs, alcohol, and different illnesses all affect dreams in different ways, and I don't look at that, but it would be a fascinating subject to read about.
So I guess in your book, these 12 states that you describe, they are of people who are, I hate to use the word normal, but general...
Just healthy adults. I mean, regular healthy adults. These are all states that most of us have experienced at one time or another. Most of them we go through every 24-hour period, like particularly like you know some of the sleep and dreaming ones. Some of them are more rare and are stranger for that. So I talk about lucid dreaming. I talk about the trance. Trance is a very natural experience. It's a natural state. But there can be, and you can get into a deep hypnotic trance where I actually have imposed suggestions. That is more of a kind of special state. And I also document some of the different deep meditative states that people do report getting into. So there are ones that are more rare and exotic, but those are, you know, especially interesting to me, not just because they're really fun to look at and kind of sci-fi and cool and matrixy and wow, isn't this awesome, but they're also really revealing about how the mind works. When you take the mind to these different kinds of extremes, you're kind of triangulating in on the whole thing in a new way.
You opened the book by talking about an experience you had when you were a tree planter. You worked as a tree planter. Mm-hmm. You would set out at 9 a.m., you would plant, and then you would, I guess, do whatever you were doing, and then you'd look at your watch, and soon enough, it's 2 o'clock, and you seemingly don't remember the last 5 hours or so.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very common experience. People have that all the time, say, driving on the highway, where you look up and realize that you have no recollection of the past hour. You're like, who was driving this car? And what's going on there is, I mean, I kind of talk about that in association with the trance and the zone, which are both deep states of absorption. And what's happening there is that, you know, you've driven, I've planted trees, there are things you've done so many times before that they kind of just go on automatic. So the part of your brain, it's almost like you're kind of noticing self-aware executive processes don't need to be running the show anymore. They can just sort of let the automatic parts of your brain, you know, just take over in those tasks, and you can just sort of daydream off and wherever you want. And you could be thinking about things specifically, or you can just be kind of checking out entirely. I mean, you're probably lost, and when you kind of come to after half an hour or an hour and realize you have no recollection, you were probably just lost in an incredibly low-intensity thought, and so much so that you really have no memory of it.
And I guess this raises another curious a suggestion about sleepwalking. Are people that are sleepwalking, are they conscious?
That's a very good question. And it looks like they're not really conscious in a way that, I mean, most sleepwalkers are probably in slow-wave sleep, which is the least dreamless sleep when you're really not having vivid dreams. And so they're probably, whatever consciousness they have is like very low-level kind of thought, and maybe even not much of all, anything going on. But what happens is the part of your body, the brain that normally causes muscle atonia, which kind of paralyzes you from the neck down, it gets disengaged somehow, and so they kind of stagger up and, you know, just, you know, zombie through the room. And usually the kinds of behaviors that get acted out in sleepwalking are edge and, like, start chowing down on raw meat or something, or they go to the bathroom in the corner of the room. I mean, they tend to be kind of primitive instincts. But there's also another kind of sleepwalking. A really interesting one was called the REM behavioral disorder, and that's when, again, the same thing, the part of your brain that's supposed to keep you paralyzed doesn't work, and just it dissociates, and all of a sudden you get up and start acting out your dreams, and that can be really violent. I mean, often dreams are violent, so you have often the specter of, like, spouses, like, attacking their wives, husbands attacking their wives, or, like, you know, suddenly tackling furniture in the room because they're dreaming about a football game. So there's all these really interesting ways in which consciousness can be remixed, that modules that are really supposed to be active only at night get fired up during the day. And also, in a sense, when you look at lucid dreaming, that's kind of an example of, like, a particular kind of waking consciousness that gets fired up at night inside the dream. So there's all these ways in which you can remix consciousness and reorder how the brain works.
Something you talk about in the book that I found interesting is electricity, and how ever since the electricity has been discovered, that it's changed how conscious we are. How significant has that effect been?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, it's a slightly controversial thing to say, but there's no question that that artificial light affects our biological rhythms. So if you were to turn on a really bright light, that'll delay the onset of melatonin, which is sort of the hormone for night. So it has a chemical effect on our body. And there's a larger story there of the cultural pressures that came to bear when as a culture, we discover ways to stay up, our different sources of artificial light, that also happened to correspond with mechanized time, with caffeine, with nighttime reading. All of a sudden, there's this whole suite of cultural pressures that kind of crowded sleep into a single 8-hour chunk. But it looks like there may have been a way in which we slept earlier on, pre-industrial revolution, that was actually, we would go to sleep when it got dark, and we would have 12 hours to be down in the dark, and our sleep kind of stretched out, and there was probably moments when we were awake in the middle of the night that had a very different character than the kind of waking that we think of now. It was more meditative, and higher levels of a hormone called prolactin are in the body. So that's one of the altered states that I investigate, is called the watch, and that's the state of waking up in the middle of the night.
And so we haven't slept better then, is that essentially what it is?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's that, there's a lot of research about how we're walking around all sleep-deprived these days, and we're not getting enough sleep. A lot of, sleep doctors talk about that. That's not the particular agenda of my book, but I do think that it's true that we don't, value our nights the way we value our waking, and I guess that's one of the kind of purposes of my book, is to show that there are all these really amazing and wonderful and fascinating states that we move through that have real personal value for us, and that we shouldn't look at sleep as sort of this waste of time. Instead, it's really essential and really quite fun and interesting activity.
The middle of the night, is that the best time to be awake?
I really like waking up in the middle of the night, and I think that a lot of people wake in the night and can't get back to sleep, and it's sort of a source of anxiety, and they have insomnia. I think if you recognize that these wake-ups in the middle of the night may be quite natural, they change your experience, and it goes from being something that's like you're anxious about to something you can kind of luxuriate in. And it's a really unique state, because you get to kind of percolate along, and you slip down into a dream, and you slip back up into waking, and you're kind of in this half state, and insights from your dream get mixed into waking thought, and waking thoughts get drawn back down into the dream with you. And there's something really wonderful about this idea of communicating between two different modes of being, that you're kind of like you're looking in but also out, and the edge of these two worlds. I think it's a wonderful time to be awake.
Apologize for jumping around here, because there's so many things I want to ask you. And to close, I wanted to ask what you're working on next. I understand you're working on another book.
Yeah, I'm just sort of trying to develop what I'm going to work on. I have so many ideas. I have too many ideas. I kind of I have to kind of pick between them. I'd like to do a larger trilogy about the mind. This book's kind of about the relationship between the mind and the brain. I'd like to do a book about the relationship between the mind and the body, of course, includes the brain, but and how other minds work together. And also, I'd love to do one about the mind and nature. But I also want to do something more playful and narrative-based. There's a lot of fun narrative in that book that I wrote, and I kind of, while I love the science and I love explaining the stuff, I also really want to kind of get more on my narrative trip. So I might try to write something altogether different, so I don't know yet what it's going to be.
And how long did it take you to, because you did sleep studies and things like that, how long did it take you to research the book?
Probably about 3 years. I mean, I started, before I ever wrote the book, I started researching sleep and dreaming on my own, just reading about it. And then I worked on those ideas, documentaries you mentioned, and that kind of fed into it. Although, again, it was like I was working on the book before I did the ideas documentaries, and then it was a kind of back and forth, synergistic thing.
I'm curious, you seem to have studied sleep a great deal. Mm-hmm. Do you think you sleep better than most people?
You know, in a funny way, I'm probably more neurotic now than ever, and I obviously worse, because I know so much more about what's happening. I know when I am insomniatic and these kinds of things, I know how to kind of get out of that and fall asleep because of the books, and that more comes from learning about meditation, and that's been a huge help. But sometimes you can have too much information. But certainly in terms of, like, you know, waking up in the night, if I want to go back to sleep, I know not to turn on the light and these kinds of things. There's all these little kind of tricks, think of the book as like a handbook to the self. You learn about all these little secret tricks about your own mind. That are definitely helpful.
And that it is. It's also very entertaining and very interesting, as I said, well written, very engaging, and highly readable. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us, and congratulations on this book.
Oh, thank you. It was a real pleasure. I enjoyed chatting with you.
The book is called The Head Trip, Adventures on the Wheel of Consciousness, $34.95 from Random House, the author Jeff Warren, here on the Plante Online program. I'm Joseph Plante.